pray for a day like today, bright and shining. Soca glory, everyone with a flag and a smile on their face. Lordy daddy, of every creed and race, Lord. Phenomenal, lovely atmosphere. If the Lord is our shepherd, who shall be fear? Ay, 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 the party starts, fantastic Friday. Sincerely from your heart, thank God it's Friday. I'm just here to say I love you. Fantastic Friday. If white somehow the blue, thank God it's Friday. Friday,
yeah, man. Fantastic Friday coming on. We're going right up until 8 o'clock. 8 a.m. that is, eh? 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. And the bouncing, we bumping you all the way. From early morning right down until soca. And soca is when we jam. And reggae we jam. And then we have a lot of, we have a new piece. We still have a new piece we're playing from Nono. Look out, look out. You're going to hear much about that for a while. Until it fades and then we bring back something else. Love and kindness, everyone. Look out, we'll be hearing from Ibrahim again this morning. So this is Ras Rico with Prince Ogona, Princess Tim Solam, Queen Victoria, Dr. T and John, who's here but never here. But sometimes here at the editorial of Princess Rachel, and always here at the instrumental and technological area, Princess Catherine. Look out, look out. We coming. Open up your eyes. Open up your mind. We with you.
Friday. Please come and join us every single Friday morning from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. every Friday morning.
Premiers and the Prime Minister. We want to have a strong Team Canada, Team Manitoba approach to the incoming U.S. administration. This is our most important ally and our biggest trading partner by far. And for Manitoba, we look at the potential impact of a 25% tariff. All sorts of stats we could share. The bottom line is it would mean a recession for our province. We can't have that happen, especially as we're starting to make progress on health care, education, and making a lot of good investments. We want to keep that momentum going. So what do we need to do? We have to show the Americans that we're serious about border security and we're serious about tackling the drug crisis. These were the points that President-elect made in his public commentary. So I think first and foremost, hitting that target of 2% spending on defense is just sort of like, that gets us in the game, just to be taken seriously as a security partner with the U.S. If we don't do it, it's going to become a trade problem. And when we're talking about cracking down on drugs, when we're talking about the border, we need to look at the RCMP staffing crisis. And being in a room full of people today who are just year after year saying we need more boots on the ground, we need more RCMP, we need more Mounties to bring the hammer down on drug traffickers, I think responding to that concern today will also help us on the trade side. Because if we can show an incoming U.S. administration, you know what? Law enforcement is getting the resources that they need, for sure more people to be able to enforce these issues, but also new technology, being able to use drones, having the coverage of the border to use new technology like drones, also when we're cracking down on those drug traffickers, that would be something needed. And I think that message is one that I'll be sharing with my counterparts, as well as the Prime Minister himself.
Get done between now and January 20th, because that's a short time frame with Christmas, with the federal backlog and sort of standstill that's going on in the House of Commons. Do you think we can get it done between now and January 20th?
I think the most important thing is to say that we're serious about this. And if the federal government, and you know, we're more than happy to play our part, right? Like we set up this new general investigative unit in Swan River to crack down on drug trafficking. We're working with the Winnipeg Police Service and other urban police forces in Manitoba to crack down on drug trafficking. I think the most important thing is to show that we're serious about these topics. And what's the downside? Manitobans want something done about drugs. So if we can tackle a major public safety issue that also helps the trade conversation with the U.S., I think it seems like a necessary step forward. So brought that message to the room here today. Be happy to work together, not just with the provinces and federal government, but also the local level leaders who are listening to you. And one
governors of North Dakota and Minnesota as well to talk about how they can help with this process.
Yeah, no, the state level partnership with the provinces is very important. I've congratulated Kelly Armstrong and, of course, Tim Walz being back in the governor's seat after the campaign that he was a part of. And then we have so many other state-level partnerships to strengthen, a lot of them in the Midwest. But let's not forget that Manitoba does a lot of trade with states like Tennessee and Georgia, Arizona, California. So this really is an important time for us to show to an American audience, when it comes to trade, Manitoba is good for your jobs.
Hey everyone, I'm Jess Turner. Make sure you listen to Fantastic Fridays on CKUW 95.9 FM every Friday morning, 6 a.m. till 8 a.m. That's way too early for me. Okay, thanks. Bye.
I'm 81 years old, and I feel very, very blessed to be alive and here among my family and my friends, and feeling great. And I think of a couple more years to go, if not more, because I'm feeling great right now. Oh, when I was a child, I was like a little tomboy. Loved to go to field with my dad. running up and down, climb trees, climb the breadfruit tree, the orange trees, the tangerine trees, ride the donkey. I always like to go to the field. I love to go on the farm where he works and be there, help to cook, to feed the people them that work. And my young days was very pleasant because, you know, I used to run around a lot and just have a good time with the other children them. You know, it's 9 of us as children. So, you know, the house is always full. And it was 5 boys and 4 girls. And my sister, Amy, and myself, we were the youngest. So we always grooved together more. And always have a great time. Always lively. Never love to fight. But picky, picky too, you know.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves.
Billie Holiday.
And blood at the root. Black bodies swinging.
Strange fruits.
In the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for
yes, anyway.
A man called Swamp Dog. Swamp Dog.
Tis the time for everyone to come to this country's aid and help repair the mess of this land that we've all made. You see, kids are tired growing up just to fight another war and singing.
Hi, I'm Julian Cooper. You're listening to Fantastic Friday on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. This is my favorite morning wake-up show.
Nakai featuring Nono. What's the other woman name, baby?
Tiny.
Tiny. and no-no. Or no tiny or tiny no-no. Hold tight. This is Nakai.
I'm Dale Rufus, and you're listening to Fantastic Fridays on CKUW 95.9, my favorite Friday morning wake-up show.
This is for my city dwellers, my storytellers, my soundscapers, music makers, and my dreamers of dreams. This is for the beat layers, the street sayers, the graph writers, and the painters. This is for the crate keepers, the image freezers, the lens seekers, and the photogs. This is for the spinners, the rewinders, drop the needle, pull it back, and come againers. This is for the movers, the body users, the kinetic acrobatic defying gravity provers. This is for the filmmakers, the actors, the activators, my sculptors, and my can sprayers. This is for the da-da-dubbers, the dancers, the scribers, the scholars. This is for the freestylers, my improvisers, my poetical, lyrical, spiritual vocalizers. This is for my speechifiers, for the visionaries, for the bridge builders, the chain breakers, the power takers. This is for the door crashers, my drum beaters, the call to action taker to the streeters. For my behind the sceners, my planners, my finders, our on task and right on timers. For our organizers, our survivors, our motivators, and our strivers. This is for the uplifters and the uprisers. This is for you, our ancestors. This is for you, our people blessers, our children, for our vision, for our villages, our hoods, our nations, our truths. This is for our culture, for our generation. This is for our creator and our creation. This is for our inner being and our outer, for our say it louder, big and prouder. This is for the art, for the word. This is for the sound. This is for the power.
So good morning, our beautiful people, brothers and sisters. I greet you with very warm greetings this morning. I want to thank Newcomer Women's Services for inviting me again to this great conference gathering. I also, too, want to acknowledge Maya Roy. And Maya Roy is the executive director of Newcomer Women's Services. And anytime that Maya is called upon, she steps up to the plate. You could call Maya and say, Maya, I am pondering whether or not I should wear purple or I should wear brown to speak to a particular group. And Maya would just break down the composition of the group, you know, all that kind of good stuff. And she would give you a good answer. But in seriousness, her capacity to bring people together, her capacity to constantly and consistently engage the organization in all that is happening in the city of Toronto, the relevant issues of the day, the issues that speak to women, to speak to the newcomer immigrant experience. So Maya, I think we should give her a big round of applause because... And she does it so effortlessly, like, you know, I could do that too. Yes. So today we are here to also to hear and engage with a number of dynamic sisters and women who are doing great things in this country we call Canada. Today is the opportunity for you to network, to meet other people. At the last session that I attended, I met a sister by the name of Nandy, and she produces these pies. And I was very taken up with her and her story of entrepreneurship. And henceforth, wherever I have gone, I have told people about Nandy's pies. What was interesting about Nandy for me is this: she had access to a commercial or industrial kitchen where she could bake her pies and have her food taken care of in a space which is regulated and which is approved by health authorities, etc. And in my journey since meeting Nandy, when I encounter women, people, young people, whoever, who are struggling with access to an industrial space or kitchen, I always say to her, there's a sister.
Michael Monroe, the daughter of one of our activists in Winnipeg here, Beatrice Watson. Hold tight.
Laying on the bed, wrapped up in a blanket, smelling your scent on the pillow. Looking outside of the window, waiting for you to come home. It's more fun cooking in the kitchen when I'm cooking with you. When we're cooking for two, then we am up the food. Two glass full, but wine bottle empty. Rub up the sheets, giving you love plenty. Then we finish our cups, make up the bed, and we do it again, again and again. Again and again, tell me when you're coming home, yeah.
Ivory and Steel, featuring Winifred Abtrell from Trinidad and Tobago and the Pan American North Stars of Trinidad and Tobago. enjoy the fusion of these two instruments. You hear Winifred could tickle those ivories? Yeah, man. Okay, Patria, go on.
Watch out. Adam Mercy. Adam Mercy. Watch me now. It name. Murder me wrote and me no take back me chat. Shuffle the date me and the queen in a day park. Look how me cute and sexy like that. And me plant the can, so no better watch that. Show me step up in a life, them want to give me a fight. Show me look cute and them no look too right. They call and need to over me, man, a fight. And that now one, no time in a day life.
Hi everyone, my name is Belaine Osman. I'm a student here at the U of W. My students actually call me Madame Oz. Just letting you know, CKUW has an awesome show called Fantastic Friday, and you guys should listen to it. Stay tuned.
Blessed morning to everyone. Love and kindness to and from everyone.
Think you where you come from?
Rastafari.
As long as you're a black man.
A black woman or a black child.
No mind your nationality. You have got the identity.
And perspicacity of an African.
Cause if you come from Clarendon,
it don't matter.
And if you come from Portland,
it don't matter.
And if you come from Westmoreland,
it really don't matter. Because coming to you all the way from West Africa in a country called Nigeria is the brother they call Prince Ugona to give you news and views on Africa. Prince Ugona!
Yes, good morning, Rastafari, and good morning to all of our listeners. Zunu Kedu, Kenkwano, greetings from Africa. This episode is Transform Democracy Now, where we speak with filmmaker Rashid Mashawari, who is the director of From Ground Zero, now playing in the U.S. theaters. He says the film is an opportunity to focus on the normal stories of survival and perseverance, calling it cinema for humanity.
But this time for me, the situation was different. The images was different. The size of the massacre, the killing, we never witnessed something like this. So then I decided, okay, my coming film or my next film will be made by filmmakers from Gaza, just to give the chance to 22 filmmakers to tell their own stories, their own daily life, to get closer to the details, because I believe these people must share their own stories with the world. At the same time, you know, we are filmmakers. We are trying to make cinema, to deal with art, with culture, in spite of all what happened. We were trying to search for hope. Yes. Ahmed, he was known in Gaza before the war that he's a cinephile. He's all his life spent after watching films, searching about films, trying to make films in Gaza, from Gaza. And all the time he was looking for an opportunity to make his new film. During the war, I contacted Ahmed and I told him, join me in my project From Ground Zero. Be one of these filmmakers. This is your chance, because I'm going to show these films internationally and worldwide. And immediately he said, no, I don't want to make a film, Rashid. He said, I am trying to save my family. I am searching for wood to make a fire, to cook for the family. We are moving every day to from one place to another. And just a few days ago, I lost my older brother. So I don't want to make a film. Sorry for you. Sorry for the cinema, Rashid. And I was shocked from his answer, because I know his love to cinema. And then 2-3 weeks later, I get back to him and I say, Ahmed, let's make what you told me in our conversation. Let's make a film about a filmmaker from Gaza. He have no time to make cinema because he's trying to save his life. Show us something from your previous films. Show us your daily life and show us how you are going to make it to say sorry for the cinema. And then we agree and we come with this film, the one that everybody watching now, Sorry Cinema. I think people must know, beside all these people whose martyrs we talk about, it's been more than 50,000 now. Most of them are innocent. Most of them are people who are really searching for life. People like Ahmed Hassouna, he want to be a filmmaker. And from ground zero, we have many people who want to be a painter, want to be stand-up comedy. They want to be a dancers. I mean, people like any other people in the world trying to manage their own dreams. And I was interested in these people to tell the stories, the normal stories, the real life under all this massacre and the genocide.
Our second piece is also from Democracy Now, where Yemeni-American scholar Shirin Al-Ademi says of the Israeli and U.S. strikes, who notes that the only thing that will stop Ansarallah from rerouting ships in the Red Sea and stopping the attacks is an end to the genocide in Gaza and an end to the starvation of the Palestinian people.
As we know that the U.S. formed Operation Prosperity Guardian essentially to protect commercial ships and other vessels going through the Red Sea, that the Houthis, also, of course, they're known as Ansarullah, have been rerouting in support of the Palestinians, given the genocide that's occurring in Gaza. And so the U.S. has moved their carriers, USS Truman and others, to the Red Sea and have been, launching airstrikes, what they're calling Houthi targets, which honestly is just a phrase that justifies and legitimizes the bombings. These are targets that are largely on civilian targets. You mentioned Sana'a International Airport, which is the only operating airport in northern Yemen, and the port city of Hodeidah, which, of course, is the lifeline of Yemen, which is still reeling from a decade of the U.S.-Saudi-UAE campaign, the war of aggression over the last 10 years. And then most recently, Israel has joined by striking these sites directly. And so these are strikes on Yemeni infrastructure. These are strikes on Yemeni civilians. They're aimed at deterring Ansarullah's capabilities because they have been supporting the Palestinians. But as we know, that the only thing that will stop Ansarullah from rerouting ships in the Red Sea and stopping their attacks, their drone and missile attacks in Israel, is an end to the genocide in Gaza and an end to the starvation of the Palestinian people.
If you could explain, as I mentioned, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus was just meters away from the blast when the Israeli bomb dropped at the airport. What was he doing in Yemen, Professor Ademi?
So he was in Yemen as part of a mission to try to release some World Health Organization employees who have been held by Ansarullah. And he said that the negotiations have been going very well, that they reached agreements on four major points. So that was the mission. And of course, this is public knowledge where the World Health Organization goes. This is a civilian airport. And it was known, he himself says, that he assumes that whoever needed to know where he was, that he was there in that location at that particular time, would have known. So it is not a coincidence that Israel targeted the airport while he was there, just meters away. As you mentioned, he still says that he suffers from tinnitus from the blast. There were six people who were killed, 40 Yemenis who were injured. So this is a really significant development that, honestly, I'm pretty shocked that it's not more widely known and reported on. It just seemed to have disappeared in the news. The targeting of the World Health Organization's Secretary General, essentially. And I would say targeting is the appropriate word, because like I said, they would have known that he was there at the time. So I think it sends a message to the World Health Organization to, maybe they don't know why he was there, but Israel can apparently do no wrong. So this is not surprising that they've gotten away with doing what they've done in Palestine and Yemen, bombing their neighbors across the Middle East. And yet, you know, they're given the green light to commit these atrocities and to target whomever they want, to target Yemeni infrastructure, to target an airport that only functions really to Amman and back, a couple of flights each week, and all because they want to continue doing what they're doing in Palestine with no consequences.
All right, so we have a third piece here as well. I'm just going to give it a play.
The AHA is, again, the oldest learned, continuing learned society in the U.S., and I think it's among the very few that were created by an act of Congress. So the AHA is kind of almost a gatekeeping organization for the history, not just of the United States, but because it's not just historians of the U.S., it's historians of every place on the globe. And so, you know, I think it has generally been a relatively moderate, sometimes even conservative organization, but I think over the years it has become increasingly clear that we can't have a narrow definition of what our roles are as historians, and there's been more and more of a willingness to take a position on issues that relate directly to our roles as historians, as educators, as researchers, as archivists. And so this is really a significant indication of the organization's willingness to think about its role more capaciously.
And so if you can talk about the positions it's taken in the past, even as you were president in 2007.
So in 2007, I think that was a first moment when we were willing to do this, because I just to very quickly say there's a backstory to this, which is that during the Vietnam War, the AHA was very resistant to taking any kind of position on the war, insisting that it was not a political organization and therefore could not take a position. But by the time we're talking about the Iraq War, we could already see the implications that the war had for doing research, for traveling to conferences, that it was having an impact on the lives of scholars. And so the connection between what the association does and what was happening in the world was becoming clearer and clearer. And that resolution passed, the condemning the invasion of Iraq, fairly easily. So it indicated a real turn in the association.
I really have to give credit where it's due, which is to the Historians for Peace and Democracy, which is a group that actually began in 2003 under the name of Historians Against the War. And they really, they were really the spearheads and leaders of this resolution. I think it's really significant. As a historian of Palestine, the American Historical Association last January, in the 3 months into the beginning of the genocide, did not have any panels on Palestine. And I remember very strongly feeling like I was in an alternate world with this huge conference, right? It's one of the largest academic associations that has, correct me if I'm wrong, Barbara, 11,000 members. And it was so shocking to be at a conference in the midst of this interminable grief, a conference of historians, and not have a single word being talked about directly centering Palestine and the Palestinians. And so this moment was one I never thought I would experience, in which we are really recognizing both the Israeli assault and destruction of the education system in the Gaza Strip. Since October 2023, Israel, armed, aided, and abetted by the United States, has destroyed 80% of the schools in the Gaza Strip and every single university. And another thing that I think is often put to the side or marginalized, and we really have to center as historians, is that almost every single archive, library, and bookstore have been bombed and destroyed by Israel. And so this genocide is really attempting to destroy our capacity to narrate our past and to imagine our future and to be able to articulate a principled, but really not that radical of a resolution opposing this with such a landslide of support was a turning point for the American Historical Association and I believe for the field in this country.
Our last piece is also from the Democracy Now, where we are joined by acclaimed Palestinian poet and author Musab Abu Taha. His latest piece for the New Yorker is headlined "Requiem for a Refugee Camp." He examines Israel's destruction of Jabalia. He describes the double devastation of Palestinians who have not only been displaced during the 1948 Nakba, but also during Israel's current genocide of Gaza, placing refugees farther and farther from the dream of return.
I mean, the painful thing is that we are talking about things today and next year would happen, that we are talking about the same thing, the same losses, or even worse. So today is the anniversary of my friend's Ma'ruf al-Ashqar's killing. He was killed last year, and just 2 months ago, his father was killed in an airstrike. So today is his first anniversary. And we and the city Beit Lahia, which is next to Jabalia, the Jabalia refugee camp, is under the Israeli occupation. I mean, now when we talk about the Israeli occupation, we are no longer talking about settlements in the West Bank or, you know, or Palestinian cities occupied by Israel in 1948. But now we can talk about the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip, because not only did they expel people, and this is what I'm talking about in my piece about the refugee camp. Not only did they expel people, many, I mean, most people in the Jabalia refugee camp have been expelled by the Israeli occupation. They not only expelled these people, but they also blew up the houses in the refugee camp where people used to live for 70 or more years. I mean, the house where my maternal grandparents were born, where they grew up, where they had my mother and her siblings. This house does not exist anymore. And this is really a very devastating thing for refugees. The refugee camp is a place that should have been a temporary place for people. They should be living in the refugee camp until they could return to the houses of their grandparents or their parents or even their own houses in Yaffa, in Haifa, etc. But these people were expelled from the refugee camp. The refugee camp is destroyed, and these people are now living in other newly constructed refugee camps. And when we talk about refugee camps right now in Gaza, these are group of tents that do not protect people from the heat, do not protect people from the Israeli airstrikes. And we watched so many airstrikes that Israel carried out that were targeting tents, especially in the humanitarian zone. So the Jabalia refugee camp is the largest of the 8 refugee camps in the Gaza Strip. It was a home for about 120,000 people, all of them refugees from cities and villages close to the Gaza Strip. So it is a very devastating loss for people, not only to lose their friends, to lose their families, to lose their house, but also not to know whether they would be able to return to the refugee camp, which was supposed to be a temporary place. Just imagine, Amy, that you are expelled from your house in Yaffa in 1948, and then you live in a refugee camp, and then this same occupation comes and destroys the refugee camp. Now you are farther and farther from your dream of returning. Now you are dreaming of returning to the refugee camp. So this is really the tragedy of the Palestinian people right now. Something that really devastates my heart is that we are watching these things happening as we are talking. I mean, we have the news that Dr. Hotam Abusafi was abducted from inside the hospital. We saw the hospital where he was working burnt and turned into ashes. And we saw the news about the Hind Rajab family and Hind Rajab herself. And we saw doctors and journalists being targeted and killed. So we have all this news, and nothing is changing the world in terms of taking action against Israel, punishing it. Not only, I mean, they did not get the Palestinians their rights, you know, that are guaranteed by international law after 1948. But they are now watching a genocide being perpetrated by the same occupation, which was admitted to the United Nations just 1 year after it was established. Just imagine that it took Israel 1 year to become a member, a full member of the United Nations. And now it's been taking the whole world about 15 months, and we don't know for how many more. It's been taking them a long time even to stop Israel from perpetrating this well-documented genocide. And I would like, Amy, to draw your attention that 1 day after the Israeli army or the Israeli forces denied their position of Dr. Hassam Safiya, 1 day later, the Israeli military spokesperson issued a statement that Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya is with the Israeli army and he is interrogated because he is suspected of being a Hamas member. So this was one thing that was issued 1 day after they denied they're having Dr. Hassam Safiya. So, I mean, this tells you that Israel, whenever they are under pressure, they will succumb. They will change their minds. They will say, oh, yeah, we have him, and he's under interrogation. He's a suspected Hamas general. He's a Hamas general. He's not even Hamas. He's not only Hamas. He's a Hamas general. He's a very, very big guy in Hamas, you know, a doctor who is working with the patients, who refused to leave them, who was injured, whose son was killed. He could leave Gaza any day, because he has a Kazakhstani citizenship. And I would like to draw your attention to another thing, which is that the director of Al-Awda Hospital, Dr. Ahmed Mhanna, has been abducted by the Israeli forces from inside the Al-Awda Hospital for 350 days. And there is no information about this doctor. I mean, the world started to pay attention and to advocate on behalf of Dr. Hassam Safiya, because, you know, he had some reports, he had an Instagram page, he has been talking about the situation, so people knew him. So that's why people want him to be out, you know, because they feel like they knew him in person. But this Dr. Ahmed Mhanna, and this is the case of about hundreds of other people, these people, no one knows about them. You know, we haven't seen, I mean, I've never seen Dr. Ahmed Mhanna. I've never seen a video of him. But he's a doctor. He's the director of the Al-Awda Hospital, and he's been abducted for about 350 days, about a year. And there is no news about him, and no one talks about him. And this is the case of so many, so many people that we don't know about until they are dead, just like Dr. Adnan Al-Bursh. He was abducted from the same hospital, Al-Awda Hospital. And the people paid attention to him when he died, and people, oh, yeah, yes. I mean, we don't want to die. We don't want to suffer for people or for governments to sympathize with us and say, oh, yes, we need him, bring him back. He is innocent. No, everyone in Gaza is innocent.
Yes, you're still listening to Fantastic Friday on CKUW 95.9 FM on your dial in Winnipeg. We're still continuing to maintain truth, rights, and justice to achieve peace and love. And we say that the Palestinian genocide must be reported as often as we can to keep our eyes on that prize, the liberation or the altering or the stopping of genocide against Palestinian peoples. Love and kindness. We have another genocide that's been going on for the longest while, and it's coming in a different way. But we have in Sudan, we have Ibrahim coming to tell us some more about what's happening in Sudan. Ibrahim?
Yes, Mr. Rico. Good morning.
Morning to you, too.
How are you today?
I am still alive, as opposed to some people in Gaza and some people in Sudan. Are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yes, I'm hoping to listen to you.
No, well, I just said a word to answer you. You can take over now.
Okay, thank you. But yesterday I tried, because I think that people have been a long time here in the world. Darfur, and they don't know what the Darfur is. And today I'm going to give you a little bit of history about the Darfur, and let you have a little bit of knowledge about Darfur. The Darfur is the name of the tribe, and Darfur is a place in Sudan, and in the west of Sudan. And this tribe has been in that place. Nobody know when they get there. And they have their own language, and they have their own traditional, and they set up their own kingdom that is called Al-Sultanate Darfur. And there is another people live with them together, African people, and you can call them, there is almost like a 6 tribes together. And yes, I can begin with the 4 as a big tribe, and that's the land with their name. And also the word that 4 is a home of 4 or land of 4. And that people surrounded with another tribe like Masalit, they have their own language. And Zagawa, they have their own language. And also like Dajo, they have their own language. And they have the Berti, and they have the Midok, and they have the Birgit. And this that is the population of Darfur. You hear it, is the west of Darfur, of Sudan, sorry. And this kingdom has been long time because nobody, when they set up, but it's continuously, and that was a really very strong kingdom. It's called Sultanate Darfur, and has a relation with the different countries or the different areas. I can begin to tell you with West Africa, like Shanghai or Timbuktu. And in the east, you have the east, in the northeast is the Egyptian, and also in the north with the Libyan, and also they have the strong relation with the Mecca, and they've been donating the Mecca and protecting, and also they have the relation with the Turkey and Egyptian, yes, I said Egyptian, and also they have the relation with the Palestinian in the area of the Aqsa al-Masjid. And in the west, they have the relation with the England and with the German and the Rome. That was the Darfur kingdom, the rich in that old relation, and was really very strong in that area. And it's continuously that was being until World War One. And they're preparing themselves because they heard the French is coming in the west, like area of Peshawar, and Egyptian is coming in the east, north in Egypt, and they come into Sudan, and they send the letter to the Turk in order to bring the weapon from the German, but that even not is so delayed, and war is begun from Sudan with the English colonizers, and eventually they reach in Darfur. And the first time in my knowledge, I heard the English use the air force in the Sahara of Darfur, and they fought, and that was in 1914. And in 1916, eventually the king, the Sultan of Darfur, is named Ali Dinar. He was killed, and that's the end of the Sultanate of Darfur. And eventually the British conquer, and they stay almost like 4 years. After 4 years, the Sudan became independent, and that is the end of the Mamlaka of Darfur. And eventually that African people is still there, and that you always hearing from the crisis from there and that kind of things.